The International Community's Promise and Pathologies. The task of ending eliminationist politics might seem less daunting if people understood the enormous fundamental progress we have made in other equally challenging areas of domestic and international politics. The importance is twofold. First, hard-won substantial improvement in some critical spheres suggests that progress is possible in others, including in reducing eliminationist politics' incidence and magnitude. Second, the specific progress made in international politics' other spheres helps explain the difficulty in bringing about the changes necessary to diminish eliminationist assaults. Three crucial major areas of progress after long, difficult, and costly struggles are 1. To provide in many countries institutional and political protections for basic civil and human rights domestically. 2. To delegitimize and mainly end the imperial conquest and rule of foreign territories. 3. To remove, to a considerable extent, war and its possibility as a fundamental means for countries relating to one another and solving international disputes. The first, protection of people's basic domestic civil and political rights, has been won in many countries, accomplished through sustained political effort to convince people that their societies and they themselves are better off with social and economic peace, the rule of law and respect of human rights, and democratic institutions, and simultaneously to enshrine these practices in societies and politics organization, and to spread their norms so they become the common ethos. Many revolutions, wars, and domestically less violent battles had to be fought to create the political space for these developments to take place, in part by destroying non-democratic regimes, and to underscore the folly of organizing politics and society along other lines. Several international developments contributed to the second and third achievements of decreasing the incidence and political use of war, conquest, and the rule of foreign peoples. War's costs are now recognized to be astronomical. Wars wreak physical destruction, ruin national finances, injure and take the lives of combatants and non-combatants, also having adverse economic consequences, and, in preparing for and then fighting wars, distort a country's economy, society, and polity. Democracies spread, especially among the most industrially and militarily powerful countries, has also reduced the appetite for war. Democratic regimes rarely fight each other. Democratic governments seek peaceful solutions to conflicts because their publics, ultimately holding them electorally accountable, do not want their husbands, sons, neighbors, and countrymen dying unless necessary for national defense, usually narrowly construed. For these and other reasons, including its delegitimation owing to conceptions of human rights and people's right to self-determination, colonization has become too costly and is seen as wrong. No longer a path to glory and supposed moral virtue and economic benefit, colonization is now commonly understood to bring the opposite, condemnation as oppression and exploitation. In many countries, especially the most powerful ones, two norms have replaced conquest, extraction, and glory. Capitalism's bookkeeping calculus, the desire not to sacrifice one's own citizens for archaic values of adventure, manhood, and glory, and people's right to political self-determination. The industrial democracy's immense international, institutional, and informational power has extended democratic and enlightenment values, meaning domestic rights, around the globe, gaining constituencies in other countries. This in itself has strengthened many countries' peoples favoring basic human rights and made such values a part of virtually all countries' public norms, which in turn is powerfully self-ratifying and self-reinforcing, exerting pressure on governments and political leaders to live up to their publicly professed values. Democratic and Enlightenment norms' precise contribution to these developments can be debated. Yet, in altering how people, especially economic and political elites, came to understand what they valued and how to achieve their goals, their understanding of the social and political institutions constituting self-interest moved in these more ethically defensible directions. Many countries' leaders and peoples came to understand that democracy, even if it entails sharing wealth and power often with disparaged groups, best promotes domestic peace, security, and prosperity. Most of the leaders and peoples of the world's wealthy and powerful countries have similarly come to understand that imperialism leads to neither glory nor economic benefit, as was believed for hundreds of years, but the opposite. It is costly, distorts a country's priorities, social compact, and politics, and leads to social strife in addition to and partly because of lives lost. War produces war. Many countries' leaders and peoples, especially in democracies, have come to understand that, win or lose, war is economically self-destructive and corrupts one's own society, not to mention kills off its young men. It therefore should not be undertaken lightly or without regard to its enormous human, material, social, and ultimately likely substantial political cost. Essentially, the institutions and norms that reduced domestic oppression and rights violations, imperialism, and, among the economically and politically advanced and powerful countries, war, first emerged out of enlightened self-interest before being institutionalized and turned into powerful norms around the world, even if they have been imperfectly distributed and observed. These, at least partly self-regarding norms, have further and crucially become integral to international organizations, treaties, and norms, and built-in political restraints in democratic polities, constitutions, notably Japan's, and policies. These developments domestically in many countries and internationally are major advances. Right-thinking people around the world form a general consensus, especially on the need to prevent war and imperialism, which are core principles of the United Nations, international law, and international institutions. These are world historical advances, yet they could not have been foreseen in 1900. Why should we take for granted that other analogous advances could not also have taken place or are now not equally possible, no matter how unlikely they may initially appear? For stopping domestic eliminationist politics and mass murder, such progress is wanting. Whatever the lip service and whatever the UN Genocide Convention's seeming provisions, strict and effective measures combating genocide, even in genocide's most narrowly construed meaning, let alone eliminationism's many forms, do not exist in the international arena. Why? Answering that question requires us to examine the United Nations and international law's failure to work towards stopping eliminationist and exterminationist politics and their active hindrance of such efforts, paradoxically owing to advances in precisely some of the same aforementioned norms, considerations, and calculations we celebrate in other realms. Existing laws and norms against aggressive or non-defensive war and against imperialism conflict with the international community's need to intervene to protect other countries' peoples from their own government's violent abuse. Such international laws and norms enormously hinder the international community and interested states from working effectively to stop such violations, even exterminationist and eliminationist assaults. The problem is clear. Forestalling impending eliminationist assaults, including mass murder, or arresting those underway, often requires countries to make what is legally defined as aggressive war and abrogate other countries' sovereignty, including perhaps by invading and occupying them, which looks like imperialism. Norms against war and imperialism have prevented new norms emerging for effective intervention against mass murder, expulsion, and incarceration. By default and design, the existing norms buttress the international community's do-nothing practice regarding eliminationist politics. They complement the virtual global absence of a push for effective intervention with an active anti-interventionist stance grounded in norm, institution, and law. Countries genuinely disapproving of eliminationist politics do not do what they and others have done with war and imperialism, and what might be expected, namely work passionately toward effective international measures to prevent states from exterminating people. The countries most engaged in domestic eliminationist politics, non-democracies and sham democracies, better described as tyrannies, including until recently most UN members, want to maintain such politics' availability, so they do not want to empower the United Nations or other countries to interfere in their domestic politics. They fear, perhaps rightly, that their practices of denying democracy, ruling by violence and intimidation, and abrogating civil and human rights would come under international assault. The United Nations and international law's insidious hands-off politics creates the circumstances for a still greater systematic danger. As today's political repertoire includes eliminationist measures, and as ruling non-democratic or tyrannical rulers live by the sword, tyranny's leaders and supporters know they themselves might one day use eliminationist means, which are part of today's normal political repertoire. Most dictatorships employ murder, terror, or other violent practices at least episodically. Many use such violence systematically. All rely upon their threat. None, in principle, is far removed from circumstances that will move its leaders to escalate and expand their daily ruling methods into mass murder or elimination. To understand why international protections generally favor non-democratic, brutal governments and not the people they oppress, we must look to the United Nations' history. The United Nations, whatever else it did, for more than 40 years served one of our time's most generally destructive and specifically mass murderous regimes, the Soviet Union, which could veto all resolutions of the Security Council, the United Nations' effective governing and critical lawmaking body. No major initiative, legal or institutional, could succeed that threatened the Soviet Union's or its many client regimes' freedom to practice eliminationist politics. The UN Genocide Convention's deformities and problems, as we know, greatly resulted from the Soviets' insistence on eviscerating the convention, so it could not stop its own and its clients' eliminationist practices. The convention's exclusion of the mass murder of politically as opposed to ethnically defined groups, its requirement that an explicit intent to commit genocide be behind the murderous assault, and its high threshold of comprehensiveness and scope for mass murders to qualify as genocide, produced window-dressing law covering up inaction. That the United Nations would not adopt other measures and laws to effectively combat eliminationist politics was a foregone conclusion, given the Soviets' veto, and starting in 1972, Communist China's. Rogue and lawless Soviet Union and later Communist China as veto wielders and central lawmakers alone would have inherently corrupted the United Nations and prevented it from combating eliminationist politics. Still, more lies behind its failures. For virtually all of its history, the UN membership has been overwhelmingly dictatorships. As recently as 1987, 60% of the member countries were dictatorships, and only in 1991 did electoral democracies finally hit the 50% mark. Dictatorships and tyrannies dominated the General Assembly. Many supported the Soviet Union in the Security Council so it would not be isolated and more obviously branded an outlaw regime. Even since the Soviet Union's fall, the UN membership has never dropped much below 40% dictatorships. In 2009, it stood at 38%. Throughout its history, the United Nations culture and bureaucracy has greatly comprised representatives of regimes wanting most of all a free hand to maintain their illegitimate rule, including by using eliminationist violence against those challenging or seeking to depose them. Finally, Western countries, particularly the United States, have conducted themselves deplorably during the United Nations' many decades. They, too, had little desire for the United Nations to act effectively against eliminationist politics, for the same egoistic reasons that democratic countries have barely lifted a finger to stop mass murders. Worse, in the context of the Cold War, the United States and other democratic countries prized a regime's political allegiance more than its domestic practices, so they ignored or supported right-wing client regimes even when they slaughtered or eliminated their opponents, communists, Democrats, members of ethnic groups challenging their rule, or virtually anyone the regimes declared to be allies of their particularly leftist opponents. During the 1970s and 1980s, the number of American client states practicing mass murderous politics exceeded those of the Soviets. The communist world's implosion, the Cold War's end, and democratic countries' numeric increase since the 1990s removed or greatly diminished several of the insuperable structural impediments to transforming the United Nations and the international community into effective agents against eliminationist politics. The continuing obstacles of a tamer China and Russia notwithstanding, the international context for combating eliminationist politics has progressed. The Cold War's binary logic so overwhelmed political leaders' meager ethical impulses regarding international affairs that progress in combating or even not encouraging mass murder was all but impossible. Two of the rare actions, in Bosnia in 1995 and in Kosovo in 1999, to stop eliminationist onslaughts, which under NATO's auspices the United States, together with France, Germany, the United Kingdom, and other alliance members undertook, would have been unthinkable during the Cold War, for fear of escalation into a shooting war with the Soviet Union. For the past 10 years, the number of democratic countries has hovered around 120, about 63% of all countries, the most since the United Nations founding, and almost twice as many as just 20 years ago, on the eve of the communist bloc's disintegration. The overwhelming obstacle tyrannical regimes pose to addressing eliminationist politics has substantially lessened. Another set of factors, related to but not reducible to the first, has synergistically shaped the United Nations and the international community's malign neglect of eliminationist politics. The United Nations was founded after two world wars left tens of millions dead, ravaging Europe and East Asia. With modern warfare's unprecedented destructiveness and the development of nuclear weapons, the United Nations' first and overwhelming priority understandably became preventing war. With many new countries and many new UN members emerging with the imperialist powers, United Kingdom, France, etc., retreating from their colonies around the globe, anti-imperialism understandably and rightly became the developing world's rallying cry, and consequently the rest of the world accepted it as a bedrock principle. Marked by similar deformities of membership and history, the world's major regional organizations, including the African Union, the Association of Southeast Nations, and the Organization of American States, hold as a cardinal principle member states' non-intervention in other member states. The African Union, which was created in 2002 as the Organization of African Unity's successor, for example, explains, "The main objectives of the OAU, created in 1963, were, inter alia, to rid the continent of the remaining vestiges of colonization and apartheid, to promote unity and solidarity among African states, to coordinate and intensify cooperation for development, to safeguard the sovereignty and territorial integrity of member states, and to promote international cooperation within the framework of the United Nations." Anti-imperialism? Emphatically yes. Primacy of member states' sovereignty? Emphatically yes. But nothing about intervening against those same states to safeguard people's lives and rights, even when a state perpetrates genocide. Together, the United Nations' foundational mission to prevent aggressive war and its and most countries' reflexive opposition to one country's occupying another for whatever reason impede the world from addressing today's acute problem, exceeding certainly imperialism and arguably also interstate war. Eliminationist politics in its most extreme version, mass murder. Why? Because dealing with eliminationist politics effectively, especially once a mass murder or elimination begins, usually requires an intervening country or alliance to initiate hostilities against a country that has not attacked it. And, to replace an eliminationist regime, an outside power or powers likely must occupy the country. The first looks like aggressive war, and the second like imperialism. Furthermore, the countries most capable of intervening, including by violating in other ways the near sacrosanct principle of state sovereignty, are past imperial powers, which the United States is seen, partly rightly, to include, which triggers the developing world's and their Western vocal sympathizers' anti-imperialist reflexes even more intensively. Thus, for decades, the United Nations, the international community, and its individual members have been all but completely hamstrung in fashioning any real response to the world's rampant eliminationist politics. One might have thought that now, after the Cold War, with war not a thinkable option between a good part of the world's countries, and with imperialism, except in the margins, a dead letter, the United Nations would be able to seriously address eliminationist politics. New, hopeful initiatives reflect this changed international landscape, most notably around the concept of the responsibility to protect peoples their own governments kill or harm, a movement that gained steam with its December 2001 foundational report, The Responsibility to Protect, calling for states to intervene in a country, in other words, ignore sovereignty, when a government slaughters civilians. In a 2006 resolution, the UN Security Council tepidly and in passing acknowledged the responsibility to protect. Yet, like the Genocide Convention itself, the responsibility to protect has little actual force, lacking a clear triggering mechanism or prescribed intervention. So far, it has not changed the response of the international system, and especially that of the United Nations, to eliminationist politics. Intervention to forcibly stop the massive political Islamist exterminationist and eliminationist onslaught in Darfur, or the one in southern Sudan before it, did not happen before the United Nations recognized the doctrine, and it has not happened since. The United Nations suffers from its first several decades' profound deformities, and the continuing membership, including veto-wielding membership, of countries wanting to preserve their international impunity to slaughter and eliminate unwanted groups. Even today, the United Nations, far from being a force against eliminationist politics and assaults, de facto protects, if not legitimizes them, by vociferously defending countries' sovereignty. Really the sovereignty of states or their leaders, and the pseudo-principle of non-interference in other countries' internal affairs, even when states slaughter their own people. The American ambassador to Burundi during the 1972 mass butchery could declare shortly thereafter, "The United States simply should not interfere in any way with the internal affairs of another country." Although both a cynical statement, the American government merely followed its self-conceived interests in doing nothing, and a hypocritical one, the United States intervened routinely to weaken or overthrow regimes, the statement also comported with the overwhelmingly defended international consensus the United Nations grounds and most robustly maintains. According to the American ambassador, direct unilateral intervention was out of the question. Why? It would have been contrary to our policy of non-intervention in the affairs of African states. In his view, the United States rightly left it to the Organization of African Unity and the United Nations to carry out their responsibilities, which everyone knew they would not do. Whatever the United Nations' small symbolic steps against eliminationist politics and assaults may be in general, and whatever occasional good it does to help victim peoples, the United Nations has effectively legitimized, codified, encouraged, and pursued a hands-off politics providing cover to mass murdering and eliminationist regimes. The United Nations has consistently done this, not just in Burundi, but also in China, the former Yugoslavia, Iraq, Rwanda, Congo, Sudan, and elsewhere. Whatever claims and appearances to the contrary, the United Nations and the international legal system are organized to allow states to pursue eliminationist politics, including mass murder. The debate about the United States and Britain's prospective invasion of Iraq in 2003, for all its confusion and false pretenses, highlighted this central problem. To be sure, politics, to put it crudely, those against and for American power's exercise, informed people's positions from the run-up to war to the subsequent occupation. Much argument on both sides was insincere rhetoric. Nevertheless, one central issue was almost entirely absent from the discussion. Saddam was one of our time's worst mass murderers, which in principle should be cause enough to forcibly remove him and his regime from power. What's more, in principle, it should be other states and the international community's duty to do so. Whether it is a wise or prudent undertaking, taking into account other important principles and the costs, damage, and death the practical measures to remove him might produce, is also a critical issue, which becomes relevant, however, and must be assessed case by case only after the primary principle is recognized. Mass murderers have no right to rule and thereby to slaughter people. Saddam had already started two murderous, aggressive imperial wars, against Iran in 1980 and Kuwait in 1990. His regime had already conducted three systematic exterminationist campaigns against Iraq's people, the Marsh people, Shia, and earlier, including with poison gas, Kurds. To maintain his tyranny, he regularly murdered and brutalized and tortured political opponents and others. Saddam, his regime, and the people serving it murdered perhaps 500,000 Iraqis, in addition to the million deaths he caused in trying to conquer parts of Iran. There was absolutely no reason to believe that, absent an invasion, one, Saddam would be deposed anytime soon, that, two, he would not continue mass murdering tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands more Iraqis, and, three, that his eventual successor would not be another Ba'athist tyrant, probably a son, probably the similarly brutal and murderous Audet. This is all aside from the untold, non-explicitly murderous misery Saddam was causing Iraqis, including children's and others' deaths from his continuing ruining and plundering of Iraq's economy to maintain his rule and pursue his megalomaniacal schemes of grandeur. When, 10, 20, 30 years down the road, the Ba'athist regime would end, Iraq would have likely faced all the disintegrating tendencies and conflicts that appeared after the American and British military victory, but without the powerful military presence that greatly dampened such disorder, and that has, at least for now, provided some possibility that a democratic and peaceful dispensation might follow. Those who favored war to topple Saddam and his regime not only acknowledged, but hammered home that Saddam was a killer, a brute, a butcher, an evildoer of epical proportions. But, significantly, the arguments put forward to justify the invasion, that he had or would soon acquire weapons of mass destruction, that he sponsored terror, including that of Al-Qaeda, and the sometime and related argument that fighting terror in Arab or Islamic countries depended on democratization, did not include the right, need, or duty to depose mass murderers. Bush administration officials did not advance this argument, but not because it had nothing to do with the intervention. Instead, the Bush administration sought to maintain that attacking Iraq did not violate international law. And international law prohibiting non-defensive war-making left no room, short of the United Nations invoking the Genocide Convention and authorizing intervention, for forcibly removing a mass murderer, even one killing hundreds of thousands. Whatever the argument's moral force that the international community should have the duty or at least the right to depose such colossally lethal murderers, the Bush administration did not advance the obvious and incontrovertible case that Saddam and his regime had to go, because it would have hurt its case legally and politically, and probably even in the court of public morality shaped by the laws and norms of the international arena. In making the case for deposing Saddam, the Bush administration and its supporters at least did state clearly that Saddam was a mass murderer, placing him alongside Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and our time's other most brutal killers. Those opposing the prospective American invasion barely addressed this, except for the few saying in passing, "Yes, of course Saddam is a bad guy," or, "I'm not defending Saddam, who is a murderer," before moving on to their many reasons for opposing a war to depose him. The all but complete failure of the war's opponents to acknowledge, let alone openly consider, the desirability, the necessity, and in principle the duty of deposing mass murderers, and also to see this duty as integral to assessing the rightness and wisdom of getting rid of Saddam, is shocking. This failure was even more glaring in the human rights community, which, with exceptions, stood almost united in opposition to the war and in silence about the principle that removing mass murderers from power ought to be a priority in international politics and law. The long-standing and ongoing international legal and political system's perverse failure to consider states and international institutions' rights and duties to stop eliminationist politics and depose its practitioners inhibited a discussion of the principle from entering the public discourse in the run-up to the Iraq War. In my many discussions with scholars and non-scholars before and during the war, and then during the occupation and continuing fighting, including the sectarian slaughter of many Iraqi civilians, my enunciation of this principle was the first time most had heard it. In other less heated instances, such a discussion had taken place, including among those earlier calling for or lauding American or NATO intervention to stop Milosevic in Bosnia and then in Kosovo, and those in the human rights community already working on developing a political and legal norm of the responsibility to protect. Yet when confronting Saddam, acknowledging, even uttering this principle was, for political reasons, anathema to the war's opponents. There were reasons, including principled ones, to oppose the American and British attack on Iraq. The Bush administration's wholesale misleading of the U.S. Congress, the American people, and the world about Hussein's weapons capabilities and existing programs, and about his ties to Al-Qaeda, in retrospect substantially strengthens the pre-war arguments against the invasion. Now that the war against Saddam's Iraq itself is over, though the occupation and its aftermath with its various sectarian insurgencies are still being played out, at this moment uncertainly for a democratic, peaceful, and economically prosperous outcome, a retrospective cost-benefit analysis, including the massive death, destruction, and displacement, can seriously begin. But none of this speaks to the principle discussed here, that the international community ought to depose mass murderers. Before the war, in the United Nations and in the broader international legal, political, and journalistic discussions about how to proceed, the international community's sacrosanct principle against non-defensive wars trumped almost every other consideration. The Bush administration's doctrine of preventive, defensive war was meant to stretch the concept of what constitutes defensive, thereby grafting it onto the generally accepted, legitimated reason for making war. The principle against non-defensive wars trumped any positive and systematic consideration of the principles and pragmatic arguments for forcibly removing Saddam. Whatever conclusions people would have drawn after assessing the competing principles and the prospective cost-benefit calculus, such an open and honest assessment did not take place, certainly not in the major public forums, not in the United Nations, not by political leaders, and not in major media in different countries of which I am aware. The Iraq War shows how little the international community and the United Nations are willing to consider the most acutely needed military interventions to free people not from foreign occupiers, but from homegrown tyrannical rulers and regimes. The fraternal principles of sovereignty and proscription of non-defensive wars govern an international system that, its self-professions notwithstanding, effectively and as a practical matter sanctions mass murder by providing tyrannical regimes insurance policies for repressing, terrorizing, and murdering their peoples with impunity. The responsibility to protect movement to sanction intervention against a state slaughtering its own country's people, and the UN Security Council's recognition of it, make the international system's recent stance toward eliminationist politics a little more complicated than this. A discussion, and in some quarters a vigorous one, is now taking place about prevention and intervention. Task forces and groups seek to reform the United Nations. Kofi Annan, with the guilt he bears for the Hutus' extermination of the Tutsis, not to mention his willful inaction as UN Secretary General toward many eliminationist onslaughts during his tenure, felt compelled in 2004 to promulgate an action plan, hollow as it was, witness the United Nations' abject failure in Darfur and Congo. The United States has a seemingly serious high-level commission, led by former Secretary of Defense William Cohen and former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who has also made an about-face since her infamous statement that intervening in Rwanda would be folly, working to produce a comprehensive and effective approach to preventing mass murder. Proposals urge establishing a UN rapid deployment force, which could be a critical aid should an effective one ever exist. We have an International Criminal Court, which, whatever its founders' good intentions, was also a low-cost way for world leaders to seem to be combating mass murder. But unfortunately, the discussions that do occur are riddled domestically in the United States, and to a lesser extent elsewhere, by left-right politics, and internationally with the often paralyzing politics resulting from powers and symbolisms calculations. Bad faith and hypocrisy govern discussion about stopping mass murder and other eliminationist onslaughts. Myriad other political considerations unjustifiably take precedence over any serious confrontation of the problem. In addition to the failure of the Iraq War's opponents to genuinely confront Saddam's mass murdering, the Bush administration's bad faith must be similarly cited. The war's opponents correctly pointed to the selectivity of U.S. interventionism. The argument that because you do not depose all mass murderers, dictators, and brutes, you should not depose any, similar to an argument no one dares to venture that because you do not punish all your society's murderers, you should punish none, is a logical, moral, and policy embarrassment. Nevertheless, it does highlight that the Bush administration, like other American administrations, was unconscionably selective in compassion for victims, blithely inattentive to eliminationist politics victims elsewhere, and cynically uninterested in stopping the perpetrators. The United States' woeful response to the catastrophic mass murdering, population expulsions, and related deaths from starvation and disease in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Southern Sudan, Darfur, and elsewhere demonstrates its political leadership's continuing disregard for seriously combating mass murder and eliminationist politics. Contemporaneous with the run-up to the Iraq War, the war itself, and the war's tottering and uncertain nation-building aftermath, these other mass murders and eliminations exceed Saddam's in Iraq and would have cost far less to end militarily. Indeed, speaking candidly in the pre-9/11 world, Bush himself declared his real view. on American national television, invoking the morally bankrupt but rhetorically powerful justification of national interest, here called strategic interest, he proclaimed that the United States should not send our troops to stop ethnic cleansing and genocide outside our strategic interest. September 11 did not lead Bush to alter his position that when a government is slaughtering and expelling hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children in a country or context deemed not to affect the U.S. national interest, American soldiers must not be risked. Bush's holy grail of strategic interest, narrowly construed, echoed Clinton invoking the cumulative weight of American interests in 1994 at the height of the Hutus' slaughter of Tutsis to justify his inaction. Clinton's Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, citing the absence of any national interest a year earlier during the Serbs' eliminationist assault on Bosnians to rationalize the United States allowing that mass murdering and expulsion to proceed. Bush merely echoed what has guided every American president during our time, and the views most of the policy elite and probably a large majority of the American people appear to share. Bush and his administration, like those before them, stood by and watched the ethnic cleansings and genocides before their eyes. The Europeans are better only occasionally in paying lip service to how horrible it all is. The United States has conservative interventionists and conservative isolationists and liberal interventionists and liberal isolationists. Yet each group's support or opposition to U.S. intervention depends more on the particular case's implications for American power and their respective conceptions of the national interest, American power being one integral component. Again and again, political leaders and elites prove themselves egoistic, with little if any inclination to act morally in the international arena, particularly when it might incur substantial costs for them or their societies. Even political leaders and elites, especially powerful international actors, not trumpeting the national interest, narrowly construed, tack to it closely. In other countries, similar considerations about American power and their own national interests guide political and media elites' assessments of the desirability of American intervention abroad, which, whether they like it or not, is necessary for the effective international intervention in most every part of the world. The recent slight progress in the international community's stance regarding eliminationist assaults remains a distraction from the most fundamental and enduring fact. The international community, as exemplified in law, institutions, and politics, is organized in a manner that makes stopping mass murdering and eliminationist political leaders enormously difficult. Thus, it almost never happens. States sometimes do act or consider acting to stop mass murder and other eliminationist policies when proximity makes such horrors more real, tangible, emotionally unavoidable, or costly. The three principal kinds of proximity affecting political leaders are geographic, actual or virtual, such as on television, circumstances and events impinging on material or political interests, and fellow feeling, commonly called identity. We need to increase leaders' and ordinary citizens' proximity to other peoples along these dimensions. But this is not easy, even if some progress is possible and, in any quantity, potentially life-saving. The international system's current disheartening state notwithstanding, a more precise view of its features and its somewhat improvement can help us think through the measures that would reduce the mass murderous and eliminationist toll in the coming century. Ordinarily, we focus on the factors causing or generating mass murder and elimination. This helps us understand why the horrors occur. It may also point to ways they can be prevented or halted. Yet a different, neglected perspective is also important to develop, a breaking model of mass eliminations. By examining the elements that, if properly affected, can stop them from happening, we can think more precisely about what has gone wrong and how to recraft institutions or policies to set them right. Breaks can be set at various levels and in many ways. Reducing exterminationist and eliminationist politics can occur at the international or domestic system level, or both. Even if these general systems are not properly constituted to impede eliminationist politics, mass murder and eliminations incidents can still be reduced by specifically targeting the two groups indispensable for eliminationist and exterminationist politics, the leaders initiating the onslaught and the followers implementing it. These four, the international political environment, the domestic political order, leaders and followers, interact with each other. Interventionist policies can also be intertwined and coordinated. Still, some of these are more potentially effective than others for reducing the frequency and scope of mass murder and elimination. The international arena is the most important. Only by changing its functioning can we at once and systematically affect all potential eliminationist states, leaders, and societies. International environments crucially affect domestic politics and society. In a bellicose world with countries prone to making war or armed so they could, a country devotes many more resources to armaments and defense than in a more peaceful international environment. Heightened militarism affects and distorts a country's economy, politics, and culture. In turn, it makes actual or potential antagonists more insecure, subjectively needing to further enhance their own military capacities, taking a toll on their own country's domestic lives. This reaction then rebounds back on the first country, which had armed to increase its security, making it again be and feel less secure. This international environmental paradox of attempts to increase security producing greater insecurity is known as the security trap. In a different international environment, an economic one of increased international trade, especially when international trade organizations devoted to maintaining fair trade rules, import and export opportunities affect companies' and workers' strategies in country after country and the politics that each, as well as national polities, pursue. In yet another international environment that allows most aspects of domestic political life to be governed at least in part at the international level with organizations that can promulgate and enforce binding rules, a country's domestic politics, economics, society, and culture change procedurally and substantively. This has been most evident with the European Union, which has profoundly affected its members' domestic politics and societies and their governments' operations, in no small part because a substantial part of members' national legislation implements European Union laws. The international environment's powerful and general effect on states' and societies' practices extends also to eliminationist politics. Substantially changing the international environment vis-à-vis exterminationist and eliminationist politics would greatly affect their incidence and practice. A changed international environment in a given realm or policy area alters the structure of incentives for leaders, regimes, and followers everywhere in the world. It addresses, as one must when thinking seriously about broad policy responses to worldwide problems, the rational aspects, purposive, cost-benefit calculations that contribute to exterminationist and eliminationist assaults. It does so in two ways. It creates tangible responses to eliminationist politics practice. It also induces political leaders to anticipate those international responses and alter their cost-benefit conclusions, motivating them not to initiate or continue with annihilative and other eliminationist programs. We can wait for the international system to evolve sufficiently, and perhaps it might, but in the meantime, millions will die. We could have similarly urged patience in 1990, and we'd be where we currently are. Or we could have, in the meantime, saved millions of lives from ruination and extinction. In Chapter 6, I discussed aspects of the international environment in two respects, showing first the Genocide Convention's specific multiple and abject failures, and second, the international environment's enormous permissiveness toward eliminationist assaults. I identified four dimensions that constitute the international political environment regarding mass murder and eliminations. A legal dimension: are mass murder and eliminations legally proscribed? A rhetorical dimension: are they publicly discussed and condemned? An action dimension: are states and international organizations permissive toward eliminationist assaults in practice and policy, or do they act to stop them? A hortatory dimension: do outside actors encourage or support other states and political leaders to undertake exterminationist or eliminationist assaults? The analysis revealed our time's three successive periods. The first, prior to Nuremberg and the Genocide Convention's establishment in 1948. The second, from 1948 through the early 1990s, with substantial changes starting with the advent of human rights doctrine in the late 1970s. And the third, from the early 1990s until today. During each period, considerable variation has existed along each dimension and their coalescence into a coherent environment, though in some there has been little progress according to the reasonable standard that the international community, 1, proscribes all eliminationist assaults, including small-scale and less lethal ones, 2, immediately and forcefully condemns those that occur, 3, allows for any state or states to intervene to stop such assaults, and 4, such intervention actually takes place quickly and effectively. Picking up on that earlier foundational discussion, here I explore in greater depth the action dimension. What have the international legal environment and states' actions been to prevent or stop eliminationist assaults?